All right, according to my phone, it is now 10 after, even though that clock thinks we've got a minute to go. A number of things that I wanted to mention. First, I have gone over the office hour notes of two classes. I think the best I can get is a time which has only about 7 people who can't make it out of the two classes. So as of the moment, my office hours are Tuesday at noon to 1. The only problem with that is there may occasionally be luncheon things that I feel obliged to go to, and if so, I'll try to put a note on the web page, and I can always move it to Thursday, 12 to 1, which was the other most popular time. In addition, if people are always welcome to correspond by email, and if you've got to talk to me, we can always make an appointment sometime, but I don't see a lot of point in sitting in my office for many hours when nobody comes. And if it turns out that the office hours are so popular that I'm full for all Tuesday, I'll make it Tuesday and Thursday, and if necessary, I can expand beyond that. But I don't expect it to happen. Other things I wanted to mention, I did audio recorded class last Thursday. It's now up on the web, and I will, subject to remembering it, keep doing that for all of the classes. So if you want to review what was done, or if you are in Timbuktu for some reason when we're having a class, that gives you a way of dealing with it. Also, somebody in one of these classes said that one or more of the links on my on the class webpage was broken. If you notice any links that don't work, email me so that I can fix them. I don't think I have found any as of the current one, but that may just mean I looked in the wrong place. Also, if you're emailing me, the class webpage has a link for my email address. It is better to use that address than to use my SCU Gmail address, because I look at the SCU Gmail account a couple of times a week, whereas I read my real email address several times a day, generally. So it gets to me faster. Are there any questions on course mechanics at this point, on what you're supposed to be doing when? If you're not doing a SOAR paper, you haven't given me any specific time when you'll give me a topic, but it would be nice if you had a topic in the next week or so we could discuss it and you could start working. If you're not doing a SOAR paper, you don't have to send me an outline. If you feel like sending me an outline for opinions, that's fine. If you want to come in and talk, if you have a paper, I will be glad to give you any ideas I have about the paper, which may or may not be of any use to you. You're going to be spending much more time on it than I am, obviously. Any questions on what we discussed Thursday? In general, one of the things that it would be useful for you to do is, in between one class and the next, if anything occurs to you that you now realize you didn't really understand in the previous class, make a note, and we can therefore spend more of our time talking about things that are actually useful to talk about, namely things people don't understand, rather than repeating things people do understand. All right. Useful approach. Any questions on the reading for this class? And again, when you're reading the assignment, it is useful if you make notes. Any notes for yourself, I don't care about. That's whether you want it on paper or in your memory. But if you say, this doesn't make sense to me, that's useful. I should say, occasionally, the reason it doesn't make sense is it's a typo. I have told the authors last year that I would try to send them a list of typos, and I'm continuing to try to do that. And I think I've found about half a dozen so far. Now, much of that book, of course, is readings quoting somebody else, so I don't really know if the typo is from this book or if they're just reproducing a typo in the original article. But there are some pretty clear cases, I think. But more often, if it doesn't make sense, it's because you didn't understand what they're saying, and that I can help with. All right. So anything that does not make sense to you, or anything you think is wrong and would like to explain why it's wrong, those are, again, more interesting subjects for classroom conversation than my repeating what you've already read in the book, which is sort of a last-ditch kind of thing to do that I avoid when possible. No comments or questions on the reading yet. All right. Well, do better next time. Let me start by raising one of the issues that runs through the book, runs through the 19th century arguments that the book discusses, but also the modern arguments. And that's the question of how you justify things. If you think about patent law or the details of patent law or any other law, what's the basis on which one argues that that's what it should or shouldn't be? And very, very loosely, I think there are two different kinds of arguments that are made. One of them is something, roughly speaking, in terms of justice or morality or moral philosophy or something like that. And in the 19th century arguments, that seems to have been, actually, seems to have been two versions of that. One of them is what I would think of as a rights-based argument. And that's the argument which says he created it out of his own mind, therefore it's really his, therefore nobody else should be able to use it without his permission. And that's an argument which was met by a counter-argument which said, well, he may have created it out of his own head, all right, but once he told it to other people who was in their head, they've got the right to use what's in their head, and therefore you shouldn't have intellectual property restrictions. So the arguments are made on both sides, but in both cases it's really an argument which appeals to our sort of gut-level intuition of this stuff is mine. And why is this stuff mine? Well, it seems as though the best intuitive reason why this stuff is mine is that I made it. And some people would argue that intellectual property is the most justifiable form of property, and the argument they would make is to say that when you make a computer, lots of other workers are going into making it. You're using stuff that you got that other people produced. It's really sort of complicated to say you made it. Whereas when you write a novel, you just sort of sit there on your typewriter and you could have used a pencil instead, and out of your head you spin a story. So isn't that even more your creation than anything else, therefore more obviously yours? So that's at least an argument that gets made. So that's one set. A different related kind of justice argument, which isn't quite a rights argument, is to say it is only fair that people get rewarded for what they do. So a different moral intuition we have is, I've done something that's made you people $1 million better off, I ought to get something. It's not fair if I don't. And it's not really the same argument, because you can certainly imagine cases where people do things that make other people better off, where nothing we would think of as property is involved, and yet we feel they should be rewarded. And in fact, I long ago concluded that in our moral intuitions, we really have two different categories which are different ways of looking at the world, and most of us believe in both of them. And one of them is the one I associate with rights, which says basically, did this happen by a legitimate sequence of actions? And the other is, what do people deserve? So one of them, philosopher Robert Nozick, distinguished between desert and entitlement. And let me give you my favorite example, which I think is based on one of his. Let's suppose we have a society where somehow everybody's got exactly what he deserves. I don't know how we get it. We got it. And you and I decide on a bet. We're going to bet $1 on the flip of a coin. All right? Heads, you give me $1. Tails, I give you $1. You can't say that I deserve to have that coin come up heads. So when I win the bet and you give me $1, if everybody had what he deserved before that, now I've got $1 more than I deserve and you've got $1 less because there was no dessert to win it. And yet we all have I think everybody I know has the feeling that you still ought to give me the dollar. That I am entitled to the dollar because I got it as the result of a voluntary agreement with you. It was your dollar because the system was just to start with and so forth. And that's sort of a clear example of the difference between our intuition of dessert and our intuition of entitlement. And a way I find it useful to think about it is that dessert is the God's eye view of the world and entitlement is the man's eye view of the world. That in order to really know what somebody deserves, you have to somehow be standing outside and above and know more about everybody than everyone knows. Because after all, everybody I know thinks he deserves more than he gets. All right? Each of us has sort of a biased view, and it's not quite clear what dessert comes from, but only if one were omniscient could one say, yes, indeed, that fellow has lived a good and godly and hardworking life, and things ought to come out well for him. Whereas that person, send him to hell. And everything in between. Right? Whereas the entitlement is more nearly saying, here are the rules of the game played among ourselves. I don't know if you deserve that dollar, But I know that you agreed to make the bet. You lost the bet. We both saw how the coin came up, so therefore you're entitled to it. So one of the sets of moral intuitions that I see running around among people is one about sort of legitimate moves, legitimate sequences of transaction. And you say, well, sure, sometimes you do legitimate sequences of transaction, and you're unlucky, and you deserve to have good things happen. You worked really hard, you were honest and honorable, but unfortunately you invested in buggy whips just before they invented the automobile, and you lost everything. Too bad. You're a worthy subject of charity, but you got what you were entitled to. All right? And the other view, I think, look inside your head, and I think you'll find both of those intuitions are there. And that sometimes results in real problems in our political opinions, because you can easily enough imagine cases where somebody is entitled to something he doesn't deserve, or deserves something he isn't entitled to. And then we have clashes in how we try to make sense of it. Anyway, that's a digression, but I think it's an interesting digression. So, in any case, all of that is still trying to answer the question ultimately by moral philosophy, by saying, what do people have a right to? What are they entitled to? What do they deserve? An entirely different approach is the consequentialist approach, almost entirely different. The consequentialist approach, which says, will this rule make us better or worse off? All right? So, again, you could certainly imagine a case where somebody says, well, you know, this rule is monstrously unjust, but we got to do it, because if we don't do it, something bad will happen. So those are different ways you might... Well, let me take a poll. If people imagine that they want to defend the law or criticize the law, how many people think that the natural way to do it is some version of it is just or unjust? Any law. Any law. Right. How many people think the natural way to do it is to say it will have good or bad consequences? All right. Both of them clearly exist in the world. They're both feelings everybody has. It's just worth, if you watch these, if you read the discussion in the readings of the 19th century arguments, that's one of the multiple things going around. And both sides are making both arguments. All right. That's part of the fun of looking. Yeah. That's interesting, because if what you say is the reason it's a good law is that it sets an example that will make people behave in a way that makes us better off, that's ultimately how you're using your morality for consequentialist purposes. And the division is a little less sharp than I made it out, because one might have a moral philosophy that says whatever has good consequences is just. Most people aren't willing to put it that way, but that, in a certain sense, is what utilitarianism comes down to. But I think people, yeah.
I think it's the time that it's a good outcome.
That's a further problem. That's right. That's part of why I was talking last time about economic efficiency. That economic efficiency is a pretty clumsy measure of what's a good outcome, but I'm not sure I have any better ones. So that I sort of tend to think of a good outcome as people getting what they want. Now, you might say, well, that's not a very good measure. I don't know any of you read H.L. Mencken. He's a very prominent journalist and essayist, first half of the 20th century. And he's got a number of comments about democracy. And one of his lines is, democracy is the theory that the common people know what they want and deserve to get it, good and hard. So that's a different version of know what you want, not so positive. But in any case, if the argument is consequentialist, then you've got to think about how you evaluate consequences, absolutely. But of course, you've got the same problem the other way as well. If the argument is what is just, anybody here have a really good theory of justice? Anybody think that he has arguments about what is or isn't just with which he could persuade people who didn't already agree with him? Yes?
About
yes, do you think that you could, in fact, use Kant's arguments to persuade somebody who didn't already agree with them? All right, you're an optimist. We should do the experiment sometime. How do we prove the categorical? The categorical imperative is the claim that I ought to behave in a way such that it would be good for everybody to behave that way. Is that a fair statement? How do you prove that's true? Why is that the relevant criterion? Let us take a very simple case. Let us imagine that I am on a boat, a not very large boat in the water, And I'm thinking of going over to one side of the boat and looking over to see what's there. If everybody does that, the boat's going to tip over and we're going to drown. Does it follow I shouldn't do it? That seems to be a problem with the categorical imperative, right? The categorical imperative, again, it reflects an intuition a lot of people have, but it's an intuition that's very hard to defend logically. That the sort of the standard example that I always give is rational ignorance in voting. All right, if you think about what I think of as the civics class model of democracy, which says the reason democracy works is the politicians have to do good things, otherwise they'll be voted out. For that to work, the voters have to know whether the politicians are doing good things. For some reason, politicians never announce that they're doing bad things. And when politicians introduce a bill into Congress, for some reason, their description of the bill lists only the arguments for it, not the arguments against it. So that I don't think there has ever been a bill introduced to Congress labeled a bill to make farmers richer and city folk poorer. And yet every farm program since the 1930s has basically had that purpose. So that means that in order for the civics class model to work, the individual voter has to put a lot of time and effort into following what's going on. Why should he do that? Well, the categorical imperative would say, if we all do that, the system will work better, we're better off. And my response is, well, that's all very well, but I don't control all. I just control me. My doing it has, you know, one chance in 10 million of affecting the outcome, given how many voters there are. Why should I spend my time and energy that I could use for learning interesting stuff about economics, or playing World of Warcraft, or reading a good novel, or playing with my kids, my grandkids now. Why should I spend time I could use it in a useful way like that on getting an extra one chance in 10 million of getting the right guy elected president?
Is it better than no chance at all?
That would be a good argument if it was costless. But the fact that something is desirable doesn't mean you should get it if you've got to give up other things to get it, right?
Going back to your economic argument, yep. About the time value of money, like you're doing something, you're getting the benefit of it. So.
That's right. It's a public good problem from an economic standpoint that one chance in 10 million of getting the right guy elected, supposing there were a right guy running, which is an optimistic assumption, but if you assume that one chance in 10 million, if it comes off, benefits everybody. But I only get one person's, maybe a little more than one person. I care about the welfare of my wife and my kids and my friends too, but it's still a very small part of the population, so therefore I have a very weak incentive to do it. So anyway, Kant is popular with philosophers. Like most people popular with philosophers, I don't find it very convincing. And I'm really convinced by a much older argument by David Hume, who argued that you could not derive oughts from isses. That there was no way of starting with facts of reality and getting to what you ought to do. And I guess the most recent and perhaps boldest challenge to that would be the novelist Ayn Rand. And I found her interesting in part because she did claim, in effect, to solve that problem, but it isn't true. I mean, if you go through it, the argument she has gaping holes in it. You can always, by the way, spot a hole in Rand's argument by the fact that she's using really good, passionate oratory whenever there's a hole in order to cover it up. I don't want to be negative about Rand. I think she was, you know, a brilliant writer and a courageous woman, even if a little bit crazy and arrogant. But she's wrong, as far as I can tell philosophically. Anyway. Digression, but maybe possibly relevant digressions. So we have the problem for both halves. And in a sense, the solution to the problem of what is just and what is a good outcome is I don't have to prove it because most people already have opinions about it. So if I can convince you that having patent law means that almost everybody will be richer, healthier, happier, I can't prove that being rich, healthy, and happy is a good thing, but you already believe it, so why do I have to persuade you of it? Similarly, if I can persuade you that patent laws mean that people get what they deserve, almost everybody will see that as an argument for it, even though we don't have a good moral theory about what people deserve, and so forth. So these arguments get made, but I think they are, in a sense, less rigorous than we would like to believe for lots of reasons. Now, there's an interesting feature which I think observed a long time ago in these arguments, and that is that in principle, something could be consequentially right and morally wrong, or morally right and consequentially wrong. Do you know anybody who actually believes in anything that is? That is to say, if you say someone is in favor, are there people out there who say, well, you know, it's true. Patent laws are monstrously unjust, but we need them. Right, it's a logically possible position. Do you know anybody who believes that? Can you think of any example of any major issue where people are willing to either say, I'm for it because of the consequences, even though I see it as morally wrong, or I'm for it because it's morally right, even though it has terrible consequences? Yeah? Yeah, but... Yes, that's right. For those who don't know, it's a wonderful problem. The trolley, simple version of the trolley problem is there's a trolley track. You know, these are light rail, basically. Trolley track which divides with a switch. And you're upstream, above the switch, near the switch, in fact, and you see a runaway trolley coming down the thing. And the switch is going to the right at the moment. And to the right, there are four people sitting on the track. And to the left, there's one person sitting on the track. And they're far enough away, and there's too much noise for you to yell and warn them. And the only question is, should you turn the switch so that one person is killed instead of four? There are fancier versions of it. There's a wonderful version where you're overlooking it, and the question is, you push the fat guy next to you onto the track so he'll block the trolley to save the four people down track. That's a different version of it. And I think a lot of people have a moral intuition, which is essentially, if you don't turn the switch, four people die, but it's not your fault. If you do turn the switch, one person dies, but it is your fault. And so some people would say you shouldn't turn the switch even though the consequences are bad. Whereas others would say you should even though it feels immoral. And that gets into another interesting question about our moral intuitions. Why sort of whether you did it matters. Let me, another digression, but another interesting one, I think. If you look at all of the arguments about global warming, one of the odd things about those arguments is that people think it's really important whether it's duty human action. Well, if you think about the logic of it, if the world is getting warmer for reasons having nothing to do with us, and it's a terrible thing, and we've got a way of stopping it, we ought to stop it. If the world is getting warmer for reasons due to us, but either we can't do anything about it or it's not a terrible thing, we shouldn't stop it. So why is there all this argument whether it's due to us? Because people have this intuition, if we are causing it, we are responsible, and therefore we're somehow obliged to do something about it. Anyway, but that also struck me as an interesting feature of that particular argument. We could spend a lot of time on global warming, which I'm not going to unless you want to come into my office hours, because it's a fun subject, but that's one of the fun things about it. Anyway, let me keep going. But I find that the trolley one is one which philosophers have constructed in order to get that problem. And if you think about real-world political views, is there anybody out there who says we should ban abortion because it's murder, even though banning abortion will result in lots of kids being born to people who don't want them and growing up miserable and becoming criminals and all sorts of bad things happen? Anybody know anybody like that? Don't think I do. As far as I can tell, people who think that abortion should be banned because it's murder also think that banning abortion on the whole has good consequences. All right? And people the other way, people who think abortion should be legal, also think that having it legal has good consequences. The closest I can come is there probably are people who think that Korematsu was correctly decided. People know what Korematsu was? This is the case that put a whole bunch of innocent Japanese Americans in concentration camps during World War II. And I could certainly imagine somebody saying, yes, it's very unjust, they've done nothing wrong, and we're sure that 99% of them are innocent. But it would only take 1% to sabotage the war industry on the West Coast, and therefore we had to do it. And I'm not sure, but my guess is that a not unreasonable person could hold that position, and that would come as close. But I'm not sure, again, that I know anybody who actually does hold that position. So yeah.
I think a lot of people are willing to justify spending a lot on enforcing against drugs, even though they think it's expensive and takes away from violent crime and stuff like that. I think just on principle, people are willing to do that, or at least they're willing to vote that way.
But you think that the people who vote that way either believe that the consequences of the war on drugs are bad? I don't think they do. I think most of them think that if you didn't have a war on, well, that's, some of them are policemen who think they didn't have a war on drugs, there wouldn't be as much work for them. But I assume that most people who support the war on drugs believe that without that, a lot of people would become drug addicts, and that would be terrible. And my impression, knowing lots of people who are opposed to the war on drugs for a long time, is that most of them not only believe that it's morally wrong for me to control what you put into your body, but also believe that the war on drugs has very large bad consequences. It's responsible for maybe a third or a quarter of the U.S. murder rate, about half the prison population, roughly speaking, and believe that, in fact, the evils of drugs are greatly exaggerated. So I think it's an interesting pattern. It's not surprising. We don't like to be uncomfortable. So the term that psychologists use is cognitive dissonance, that you feel uncomfortable if you say, I've got to be in favor of this, but it has horrible consequences. So you probably persuade yourself it doesn't have horrible consequences. Yeah. That's an interesting one. Do you think there are people who say the death penalty is unjust but has good consequences? Or do you think there are people who say that it is just but has bad consequences?
I think there's people that say I understand it's really expensive, and I understand that it might not be as big of a deterrent as we think it is, and yet still I'm for the death penalty just because...
Murderers deserve to die.
Yeah.
Yeah, might be. Might be interesting to see if you actually found anybody who said that, or people who would say, no, if we didn't have a death penalty, we'd have more murders. And, of course, the people who are for the death penalty probably are not in favor of the legal rules that make it so expensive. If you think about that, the U.S. on paper has a death penalty. And I guess you might argue that Texas really has a death penalty. But the fraction of people convicted of what used to be capital crimes who were executed is very, very small. And they're very difficultly, if you think about societies that took death penalty seriously, it wasn't very expensive, right? I mean, you hang the guy, it doesn't cost anything. Make it a spectacle sport, which the British did in the 18th century. So anyway, I sort of interpret it as being expensive as in part a successful strategy by the opponents to make it more difficult in order that it won't happen as much. So I think these are the standard Latin phrase, some of you may know, for this claim that you have things that you've got to do justice, whatever the consequences, is fiat justitia ruat coelum, which is Latin for let justice be though the sky falls. And I just haven't yet met anybody who really believes that what he thinks is justice will result in the sky falling.
So we're kind of complaining
law. Yeah. I'm offering morality as one of the arguments made for laws. Right. And that's why we're talking about morality. Yeah. If we think about, let's go back to IP for a bit, since that's supposed to be the subject of this course. And if you think about the arguments, suppose you want to come out for or against patent law on sort of rights-based, property rights kind of arguments. For patent law, which does that give you? Does that give you more patent law than we have or less? By more patent law, I mean more protection for inventors. Either easier to get or lasting longer or covering more things, more on any relevant dimension.
Because
they own what they preserve, the right base. So it sounds as though that argument gives you perpetual patents. Now give me a counter argument. Tell me why, on grounds of sort of rights and property, current patent law is too restrictive. Who is the person whose rights are being violated? Yes.
Software developers have problems with the software patent because they have been building on the technology that's increasing innovation.
Well, but on the other hand, you wouldn't say that it's a right-based argument against property and land that you can't plant trees on my yard. So isn't there somebody whose rights are obviously being violated by patent law? Yeah. The second inventor. That's right, because the patent law, after all, you thought up the idea and you thought it up a week before I did. Why does that give you a right to stop me from doing it? So it looks as though the argument sort of cuts in both directions, that you can see it as either an argument against patent law on the ground, or you can see it as an argument for. And you could imagine a version of patent law which somehow said independent invention is a defense, And then the only problem is the practical problem of how do we prove independent invention, because once I've already seen your invention, it's really easy for me to think it up, too. All right? So, how about the consequentialist? Can you see consequentialist arguments? If you can't, you're going to be reading them very shortly, both for and against, both for more patent law than we have and for less patent law. Yeah. That is to say, one argument is to say that the effect of patent was the first guy who made a steam engine could then block all improvements in the steam engine until Watt's patent eventually expired, and then the claim, which is made in a book if you haven't read yet, you will be reading parts of it, the claim is that when Watt's patent expired, suddenly there's a burst of progress in steam engines because all the inventions other people had been making and hadn't been able to use. So that would be the argument in one direction. And the argument in the other direction might be that not only when I invent the steam engine do I let people use my steam engine, I'm giving them the idea which sets them working on improved versions. And after all, if I'm sufficiently clever as the patent holder, I will do what Watt didn't do. Namely, I will say to every new inventor, look, let's make a deal. I will license my patent to you in exchange for a share of your revenues, which will reflect the fact that you're making an even better steam engine. And so one interesting question, which I don't know the answer to, is why Watt apparently never did that. Because you could argue that at least in a world with sufficiently low transaction costs, where people are good at making deals, that you should never block progress with a patent, because there's always some deal that the patent holder ought to be able to make with a new inventor that will benefit both of them. And in fact, something we're going to come across at some point is that there is an argument for patent which is independent of all the standard arguments, which is called the prospect theory by a guy called Kitsch. And his argument is that turning ideas into property is actually a benefit, not a cost. Not because it rewards the inventor, but because once something is property, somebody can coordinate its development. So that his example is prospecting for mineral. And the argument is that not only does the fact that when you find your gold mine, you get a claim over it, not only does that give you an incentive to find gold mines, it also avoids the situation where there are 18 people around the borders of your gold mine digging all their gold mines, wasting a lot of resources because they want to get the gold. You can control it. You can coordinate what's happening and so forth. We'll get to that later. But that's sort of an interesting example where somebody is, in a sense, turning an argument against into an argument for. Whether correctly, we don't know. How about Locke? You've read a little bit from Locke. You may have read from him before. He's sort of the classic person always cited for the origin of property rights or for justifying property rights. What is his argument for property in general? Is that a moral argument or a consequentialist argument? Can you tell? I'm not sure I can. Any opinions? How about Thomas Jefferson? Jefferson's interesting on IP, as you may have worked out. Jefferson originally is in favor of the history of the U.S. patent system. Is that at the very beginning, it's an examination system where you bring the patent to a body of people, which included, if I remember correctly, the Secretary of State, which I think is what he was at the time in George Washington's administration. They decide whether you deserve a patent and then issue it. Jefferson apparently was instrumental in persuading them to change that to a system where you get patents automatically on demand, and then the question is, when somebody infringes, there's a court case, and the court has to decide if it's a good patent. So it's interesting, in a sense, to think about those two different models, because it's still an issue. There's one model is the model which says that somebody decides whether it's a valid patent, and then you have it. And the other is one which says, no, patent whatever you like. Doesn't matter unless somebody wants to infringe it, and once they want to infringe it, now you can go to court and decide it's a valid patent. Mark Twain somewhere has this wonderful discussion about how crazy our legal system is. I think it's in the form of a conversation with some imaginary foreigner, and the foreigner says, look, now, you've got the Supreme Court, which is supposed to decide whether the law is constitutional, right? So what happens is that Congress passes a law, and then you send the law to the Supreme Court, and they say either it's constitutional or not constitutional, right? That's not the way it works. All right. Same argument. All right? That our system for constitutionality is the equivalent of the original patent, not the original, the second patent system. We then went back to a third system that we now have. We went back to examination. And Jefferson, as far as I can tell, at least from the readings here, was partly responsible for switching to a registration for an examination, and then later decided it was a bad idea, but never actually said, oops, my fault. People are very bad at saying that, in my experience. Me too. So in any case, the way which we handle constitutionality is a registration system, the equivalent of a registration system. It's law once Congress passes it, and if you think it's unconstitutional, you got to go through an extended legal process and hopefully get the Supreme Court to say it's unconstitutional. But that is one division. But in Jefferson discussion, can you tell whether Jefferson thinks that IP is morally justified, consequentially justified, both, neither? Yep.
No
for either of them.
Kind of refutes the box. So you can't have property in an invention.
That's right.
It's just something that we give exclusive rights to profits for a limited time, just because it's...
And he also seems a little unsure even about that, because I think he makes the claim, if I remember correctly, that England, which has patents, doesn't seem to do better than other countries that don't. Although I gather later in the next century, people claim, look, England has done very well and they have patents. Maybe that's evidence patents are good. So, you know, I think both Locke and Jefferson, like all the rest of us, are in a sense straddling the fence, that Locke is, on the one hand, he says, look, God gave the earth to everybody, but what use is that if nobody can use it? Not just the earth, everything. You know, if I can't take a bite out of this apple that I just picked because actually it's all your apple too, then we're all going to starve to death. So that looks like a consequential argument. But at the same time, he's also making the argument, look, because you've mixed your labor with it by pulling the apple off the tree, that somehow makes it right and proper. And of course, he then gets into the problem of what's referred to as the Lockean proviso. And the Lockean proviso is as much and as good. So the argument that Locke makes, and he never, as far as I know, really works out the problems with this, is it's all right for me to go into the wilderness, clear some land that I can use, it's now my property, as long as there's as much and as good wilderness left for you to clear. Do people see what the problem is with this argument? Let us suppose that I am the first, leave aside the Amerinds, the Native Americans, which obviously can raise some moral problems, but suppose they didn't even exist. Imagine we had come across an empty continent. We came pretty close because the new old world diseases had killed off a large fraction of the population by the time there was any serious European arrival. But suppose there had been nobody here at all for a moment to make life easy. And I'm the first guy and I say, look, there's this whole continent. I am hurting nobody when I turn some of it into my property. What is your response going to be? You want to argue against it. You want to say you can never make turn the commons into private property because you can never meet the proviso. Yes? There will be some time, 300 years from now, when the last bit of wilderness is turned into land. And what is the effect of my turning the last bit of wilderness into land? I'm not allowed to do it, right? Because that doesn't. But if I'm not allowed to do it, then the guy before last, when he turned the next to last bit, he was hurting me because now I can't do it. Now, so he can't do it either. So go all the way back. That's what mathematicians refer to as an induction argument. And you run it all the way back in the very first person in the history of the world to turn wilderness into land. It looks like he was not really leaving as much and as good if at some point in the indefinite future it would run out. All right, so that's a problem with the Lockean argument, and there are a bunch of ways you can try to patch it. If people are sufficiently curious, let me see if I can actually find it. I've got an old article in which I offer the best. If you go to my webpage, and the second thing here is my academic work in law and economics, and somewhere here, let's see if I can find it. The silly machine is a... No, it's a Windows machine, and so I don't know what buttons do what. How do I do find? They gotta be. There we are, that's it. I'm looking at Google. I don't have Google. Sorry about that.
Okay, Control F on the
app. Control F. Thank you kindly. I know Mac. I don't want that. Control F will get me the right thing. There we are. That's what we want. All right. It's a sort of a fun article, and some of you might or might not enjoy it. There we are. Comment on Brody and social philosophy and policy about 30 years ago. But it was an attempt to sketch how you might justify property rights given that set of problems. Not a very good solution, just the best that I could think of. I haven't done much better since. But there are a number of arguments people can make. And one argument is the one that says, look, when I turn that first bit of wilderness into property, it's true I am ultimately hurting somebody in one respect, by meaning he can't turn wilderness into property. But on the other hand, I'm using that property to grow grain. I'm selling that grain in the marketplace. The result is the rest of the world can eat more cheaply, and therefore the net benefits other people get by my turning the wilderness into land more than balance the costs, and therefore you can argue I'm not really hurting them and I'm entitled to it. That's one starting line of argument that can be used, which may or may not work. Going back just for a moment, one point that's raised in the readings is the claim that the U.S. first to invent rule reflects a moral basis rather than a consequentialist basis. That is, the question is, if you look at modern U.S. IP law, it's mostly put in terms of consequences, in terms of the arguments. But the book suggests, if all we cared about were consequences, wouldn't it make more sense to answer the easy question, who showed up at the patent office first, rather than the hard question, who had the idea first? So, any opinions? Is that right? Or could you make plausible consequentialist arguments for first to invent? I'll let you think about that question. Let me go on to something else which I find interesting, and that's where property rights in general come from. And Mergis, like a lot of other people, seems to assume that property rights must be created by the state. But if you read the Demsetz article, Demsetz is describing a situation where property rights actually evolved among North American Indians with no government to create it, evolved in some sort of a decentralized fashion. And another piece of mine that you also might find interesting, which now that I've hopefully figured out how to do this, I don't even have to push any buttons because I've got my, that's right there. Oops, except I do have to go back to the previous page. There we are. A positive account of property rights here, another one of my old articles, and that's an attempt to explain really rights in general, not just property rights, as neither a moral nor a legal category, but as a description of human behavior. So if you say, what are rights? What does it mean that I have a right to something? And one answer could be, it's wrong for you to violate it. Another answer could be, the government will arrest you if you violate it. And I want to claim that a third answer is, you will not find it in your interest to violate it. And sometimes the reason has nothing to do with morality or government. Sometimes the reason is commitment strategies. Do people know about property rights among animals? There are quite a lot of species, mostly birds and fish, which are what are called territorial animals. And the way a territorial animal works is that the animal in some way marks out its claim. It marks out the area which it's claiming is its. And it then turns a switch inside its brain. I haven't looked inside the brain. This is just observing how they behave. Such that if it observes a trespasser of its own species and gender, sometimes either gender, make it simple case, own species and gender, on its territory, it will fight that trespasser, fight more and more desperately the farther into the territory the trespasser comes. Now, unless there's a big inequality of power, a fight to the death is a loss for both sides. All right? So even if you're a somewhat bigger bird than the property claimant, if you think that if you insist on coming on his territory and not retreating, he's going to fight to the death, well, he's going to be dead, you're going to be injured, you'd be better off not doing it. So that's a case where you're getting a property. It's a very primitive kind of property. They can't buy it and sell it and such, but nonetheless, it's property, and you're getting it by a commitment strategy. And what I argue in this article is that really human rights, not just property, can be understood as simply a much fancier version of that system. That what's really going on in any human society is that people have got commitments they've made such that if you cross this line, I will bear unreasonably large costs to fight you. Maybe not infinite costs, but large costs. And as long as you know where my lines are and I know where your lines are and they don't cross, as long as there's nothing that you claim you've got a right to do and I claim I've got a right to stop you to do, each of us backs off when it comes to those lines, and you then get an orderly society. And this is sort of my solution to what I regard as one of the real puzzles in political philosophy, which is how you could ever get out of Hobbesian anarchy. Hobbes famously described the state of nature as a world where everybody's at war with everybody else. And you say, well, how can you ever not be there? That, so we've got policemen. Well, why aren't the policemen at war with the rest of us? Putting a uniform on a guy doesn't make him behave differently. And what I want to argue is that the real structure of human society comes out of this mutually perceived structure of human strategy. So it's an interesting article you may want to, you don't have to read it, but it's nothing to do with this course in particular, but it has to do with understanding the world you live in, and that may be worth doing. So let me give you a couple of more recent examples of property rights without the state. And my favorite one is property rights in shoveled-out parking spaces in Chicago at winter. And I read a piece somewhere about this, and apparently what happens is that you're in Chicago and there's snow this high, and you shovel out a parking space and you put your car in it, and then after a while you leave. But you don't really want to abandon this all this work you've done. I mean, other people want parking spaces, they can shovel their own. So you put a chair, or, you know, folding chair or something in that parking space. And what does this chair tell other people? It tells them, if when I come back, there is a car in this parking place, it may be in worse condition a little while later. All right? Well, that's a commitment strategy. And that's, in fact, generating a form of rather temporary, transient property rights. But it's a property right, all right. People then choose not to move the chair and park in there because they're afraid you'll break their windshield or scratch their paint job or something else in revenge if they do. So that's an interesting example. Another example is something that I mentioned earlier, which actually is quite relevant to IP, and that's open source software. Because open source is one of the big modern examples where you are getting intellectual property of considerable importance produced in a way that doesn't seem to fit the standard IP kind of model. And open source actually has two property rights associated with it, neither of which is enforced by the state. There is one property right that is enforced by the state. The way open source works is you have an idea for a program. You write a first draft of that program. You put up the source code. How many people here know the difference between source code and object code? All right. Some don't, so I should explain it. When you write a computer program, you are writing it in a language telling the computer what to do that you can understand. BASIC was a sort of famous early example of that. And in BASIC, you write x equals 3. And what does that mean? It means set the value of the variable x to 3, and now if you later write print x times 2, it'll print 6. All right? But the computer doesn't speak that language. So you have a program of some sort, a interpreter or a compiler, which turns what you've written into a form that the computer can actually operate. And that form comes out, is statements, there's something more like, go to memory location such and such, take the number there, put it in register C of your central processing unit, go somewhere. It's very, very detailed description to the computer of what it is doing with the contents of its memory, the contents of its central processing unit, and so forth. All right. So when you buy a copy of Microsoft Word, what you're buying is object code. What you're buying is the version of that code that the computer runs. It is not literally impossible to make sense for a human to make sense of object code and do anything with it, but it's very, very hard. Whereas if you want to actually modify that code or figure out how it works, what you want is the source code, the human-readable description of what's happening. And you have the source code, you can modify the source code, recompile it, you now have object code with your variant. But there are other advantages, because suppose the program's doing something wrong. Suppose there's a bug in it. You're never going to find that bug looking at the object code. But if you've got the source code and you're clever, you can say, aha, here is where the problem is. All right, my one example from a program a very, very long time ago, I was writing some software to go with an economics text I had written. And the one of the things I had to do in this software was at some point to say, wait 4 seconds, and then do something. And the language I was writing in did not have a delay statement. It didn't have a statement which said, wait 4 seconds. So I wrote a little bit of code which basically says, read the computer clock, add 4 to that number, and keep going around the loop until the clock reads your new number. All right. There was one small problem with that piece of software. The computer clock shows the number of seconds since midnight. So what happens if that particular bit of code is executed at 3 seconds before midnight? All right, it says wait until 24 hours plus 1 second appear on the clock, and it's never going to happen because it goes back down to zero and hits midnight. Guess how I discovered that bug? I called it the Cinderella bug. Program freezes, I look at the clock, I see what's wrong. All right. If all I had was the object code, I could never have found it, because I would never have known how that statement worked. So open source, the basic rules of open source are anybody is free to copy the source code. Anybody is free to compile an object code. Anybody can move it, anybody can modify it. All right. The only thing you're not allowed to do, legally speaking, is to modify it, sell other people the object code of your modified code, and not provide them with the source code. So that's why they call it the open source movement. The basic open source rule is that anything based on open source has to stay open source. You have to keep making available your source code. There are, however, 2 other rules, neither of which is state enforced. The first rule is that the owner of the project, which is initially the person who started it, gets to decide what goes into the code base. So what that means is that if you're Linus Torvalds and you've started Linux and somebody says, I think Linux should be modified in the following version, and he sends Linus his modified version of the source code. And Linus gets to this, he can use it from now till doomsday. All right, there's no legal restriction. But Linus decides whether the version of the source code that he's making available to other people does or doesn't include that modification. Because the programmers would all like to work on the same code base. I'd like to make sure that my version has got your improvements in it. And I don't want one of the versions to have one set of improvements and another one another, so that after a while they're incompatible and we get confused and so forth. So Linus has, by custom, not by law, the control over what goes into the code base. He's the owner of the program. And Eric Raymond, interesting guy who's written a lot of stuff on open source, argues that the rules of that are closely parallel to the rules of property in Anglo-American common law. That it's the first creator who owns it, that he can transfer it to somebody else. So if Linus says, I'm bored with running Linux, here's some guy who's been contributing a lot of stuff to the code, he understands it very well, how would you like to take it over? He gets to take it over. All right. Similarly, suppose that Linus just gets tired and stops supporting it. He doesn't answer anybody's email. What do we call this? We call this abandoned property. What do we have? We have rules for claiming abandoned property. And the rules in that world, according to Eric's account, are that if a project is not being maintained, anybody else can announce in the appropriate online places, I would like to take over this project. Is anybody running it? And after a certain length of time, we call this adverse possession in the law, after a certain length of time, if nobody else has claimed it, it's his, and now he is considered to have the right to decide if it goes into the code base. Right? So that's a form of property, but it's a form of property that's being maintained by custom. What maintains it? Only the fact that the other programmers want to use the code base maintained by a single person for consistency, and this is what chooses the person. Then there's a second property right, and that is that the source code is apparently accompanied by a text file which says who wrote what. That's credit. And again, you are not permitted, meaning everybody else involved in the project won't talk to you if you meddle with that, because they want to keep the credit for what they've done. So all of that strikes me as a very interesting example where you've got a form of property that's not depending on what we always think of it. That there are various people who make this argument in lots of different contexts. Look, you don't really have a claim to your property. You only have that property because the government says so, and just isn't true. That's one of the reasons people have property, but it's by no means the only reason they do. Another point which I thought was worth making, because it's a point that the Demsetz article makes that will be obvious to economists and opaque to everybody else, And that's that property rights give you allocation across time. I don't know if people notice this, but DEMSET says you could imagine a mechanism for handling some property where somehow the whole group has to sort of vote on what it does, and that could be used to allocate property. A different mechanism is to say, I own this, you own that. Deals. And he says one of the advantages of the private property over the communal property system is that the private property takes account of the unborn. And that seems a little odd. One of the arguments is often made against private property to say, look, the unborn don't get a vote. And Demsitz says, yes, they do. And my standard example of that is to imagine that I've got some land and I'm thinking of planting it with black walnut trees. And black walnut trees are a valuable form of lumber, but rather slow growing. They're a hardwood. And I'm 75 years old, and it's going to take 50 years for those trees to grow to maturity. I'm not sure it's really 50, but make it 50. And you might say I would never plant the trees because I'll be dead before they grow, but that's wrong. Why will I, as a selfish, greedy, profit-making person, choose to plant those trees? Yep. Because I wait for 5 years when I'm 80, and I say I need some money at 80. I now sell it to somebody saying, look, you only have 45 years to wait. He, 20 years later, sells it to somebody, you only have 25 years to wait. So that the expectation of what people will pay for it 50 years in the future goes into my decisions now, because with private property I know that whoever owns it now will control ultimately who gets it in the future. So that was the point Demsetz was making, and it is not a point that non-economists are likely to be familiar with. I thought I ought to point it out as one advantage of the private property mechanism. Let me raise a different question, and this is, again, a sort of a general question which applies to IP and everything else, and that is whether we have progress in law. That's one way of putting it. This is sometimes referred to as the Whig theory of history, and the Whig theory of history is that history involves things getting better and better. That you start out with monarchy, and monarchy wasn't, we start out with feudalism. Feudalism wasn't such a great system, so you replace it with monarchy, which is an improvement. Monarchy wasn't such a great system, you replace it with a democracy, which is an improvement. Everything keeps getting better and better. And of course, the IP version of that would be to say you start out in a world without, doesn't have any patents. That terrible idea, no progress. So then they think of patents, but they originally get it wrong, and they gradually refine the patent law. And the argument that you see being made, it's being quoted in some of your readings, is that if you look at what's happened to patent law or copyright law over the last 50 years, we see that it has changed because it is adapting to new conditions and fitting those new conditions. So that's sort of the optimistic view of law in general. And the question is it true? And there are two ways, as in most of these questions, there are two ways you might try to answer that. One of them is to try to look at history and say, do things in fact consistently get better? And the other is there any theoretical reason to expect them to? What are the mechanisms that make law? Are those mechanisms which you could expect to improve it? You can certainly think of some mechanisms that do. If you think about a company that manufactures cars. All right, the company wants to sell their cars. They want to make them at the lowest possible cost, sell them at the highest price they can get for it. If an engineer comes in and says, look, I've got this idea for a change in the design of the car, what'll it do? Well, it'll make it more expensive to produce and it won't work as well. Doesn't sound like the company making cars is going to adopt that. So, except where they actually make mistakes, they've got an incentive to steadily improve the cars if they can. But it's not clear if that's true of everything. And I don't know how many of you have a historical background. Can you think of situations where things got worse rather than better? Yeah? That's not law. I put it too broadly. The question is, were political legal changes? Yes. What improvements were those? Are you thinking of the Wankel engine? Because the Wankel is the famous example, and NSU made them and couldn't make them succeed, and then Mazda, for many, many years, was selling a sports car with a Wankel engine, and they could never make it work well enough to be commercial. How do you know? How do you know? You're asserting historical facts, and I'm curious as to how you've tested them. Because the case of the Wankel is an interesting case, because that's one where it really, where exactly your claim, not suppression, but the claim was made. Yeah. And again, I want to know what is your source for the assertion. Let me go back a step. One of my rules of thumb you may find useful is that any historical anecdote that makes a good enough story to have survived on its literary merit ought to be viewed with suspicion. And you're telling a story that's really a neat story. It might even be true, but I'm only saying that the mere fact you have heard this story doesn't really tell you whether it's true or not, and that it's therefore worth trying to look into the details. Because at least sometimes when you check the stories, they aren't true. I mean, the entirely different subject. One of my hobbies is cooking from medieval cookbooks. Among the things people will tell you about that is that the reason we have pasta is that Marco Polo went to China, he observed noodles in China, he brought them back to Italy. The problem with this is that we know that there were pasta recipes in the Middle East which the Italians were dealing with hundreds of years before Marco Polo. Another story you will be told about medieval cooking is that the food was overspiced to hide the taste of rotten meat. Now, there are a few problems with that story. The first one is when anybody tells you that, you want to know how he knows, because medieval recipes almost never give quantities, and therefore you don't know how much of the spice they had. And the second question is, what do you think happens to a cook who feeds his employee rotten meat, hiding it with spices? And the third is, which is more expensive in medieval Europe, spices or fresh meat? All right, so those are examples. Not your example. My point, I'm just sort of suggesting why I think it's a useful habit to be skeptical. I'm asking what kind of sources you have that, what? Right. Yeah. There are an awful lot of information out there that isn't true, right? And that's sort of a useful lesson to learn as lawyers. Because after all, when the other side of the party cites certain well-known facts, one of the things you ought to do is get somebody to look them up. Because quite often the well-known facts just aren't true. Sometimes they are, of course, but I want to inculcate a general skepticism about what everybody knows. Because too often, I'll take another example, very famous example. What everybody knows is that when Columbus wanted to set out for the New World, or set out for India, was where he thought he was going, people told him he couldn't do it because the world was flat. All right, that's the standard story. It's absolute nonsense. Columbus was an ignoramus, or possibly a fraud, we don't know. The world had been viewed as flat by Columbus's time, sorry, as round by Columbus's time for something like 1,500 or 2,000 years. The Greeks, more than 1,000 years before Columbus, Greeks successfully determined the size of the world. They did a very clever experiment, which involved comparing the angles of shadows at two cities at noon, one north of the other, and seeing how much it differed, which if you think about it carefully enough, you can see tells you the ratio of, tells you how far around the world those cities are, and if you know the distance between them, you can figure. So they knew how big around the world was. They knew about how wide Asia was. Take a look at the globe and ask what would have happened to Columbus if the New World hadn't been there. All right, he barely makes it to America, and India is like four times or five times as far. So it's possible that Columbus knew that the New World was there and was persuading people by telling them he was going to India. But what he actually did, we know, was to take a very, very small estimate of the size of the world, which involved misinterpreting some of the units, a very large estimate for the width of Asia, and therefore to conclude that the distance from where he was leaving to where he was going was like a quarter as long as it really was. But the standard story you always hear, which makes this great story, is about how they all thought he'd fall off the edge of the world. And of course, mine is a good story too, so you shouldn't believe it either. If you're curious, the book is called Admiral of the Ocean Sea by Samuel Eliot Morison, who was a naval historian, and that's what I'm ultimately getting my account from. But I'm pretty sure it's right. Yeah.
Going back to
For a more modern case, is anybody willing to argue that Hitler was an improvement on Bismarck? That would be a pretty clear case, I think. Now, you could say that was just a temporary aberration, that presumably the current West Germany arguably is an improvement on Bismarck. But now, I would argue that absolute monarchy was a step down from feudalism, but that would not be a widely accepted view. And in my view, the modern system is better than absolute monarchy, but on the whole, absolute monarchy gets a great reputation, because if you've got a really powerful sun king type guy, he sucks lots of money into the capital and can build spectacular things and can subsidize composers and such, and if the peasants are starving, so what? You don't see the peasants. But in any case, the general issue. But let me make a different point, and that is with regard to IP law. Suppose your theory is that there are mechanisms that make it get right. How much has the term of protection of patents varied over the last century and a half? Right, if you think about sort of the consequentialist economic view of patents, what ought to determine the term of protection? Something like how quickly things are reinvented, how likely it is that your invention wouldn't be invented in X years if you didn't invent it. Is it at all likely that that number has stayed roughly constant for 100 years during revolutionary changes in technology? Very unlikely. And yet the term of patent has changed very little over. I think it goes back more than 100 years. I'd have to check it. I think we've changed it a little bit recently for drugs, as I remember, but roughly. So that sort of looks as though it's largely a dead hand of the past system going on. Anyway, I think it is an interesting general question to think about, as I say, of whether or not there are mechanisms, whether in IP law or anything else, whether the sort of optimistic view, which says things change because the conditions require new things, are right, or alternatively, whether something else is going on. Yeah.
A lot of times now, the patent lasts longer than the entire relevance of that product itself.
Yeah, but then it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Right? That's harmless. As you may know, one of the differences between 19th century and 20th century patent law is what the utility requirement is. That in modern patent law, you're supposed to actually show something is good for something in order to get a patent on it. The 19th century doctrine is that utility means not bad. That basically you should not be able to get a patent on a device to promote debauchery or private assassination, to quote a famous 19th century judge. But if it's just useless, who cares? You get a patent, nobody's going to want to infringe it if it's useless. All right. I like that sort of debauchery and device to promote private assassination. First is private assassination. Presumably the CIA, you can patent devices for the CIA, all right. And second, it seems to me that Viagra is a device to promote debauchery, and as far as I assume it's patented. But my favorite case from that is a 19th century case in which somebody gets a patent, someone else infringes. The infringer argues the patent is invalid on grounds of utility. In other words, the infringer is saying this is a patent for doing something people shouldn't be allowed to do. Therefore, it's invalid. Therefore, I can do it too. And he wins. All right? The case is one. It was a patent for stippling tobacco. Apparently, tobacco cigars were made of sometimes had a visible pattern on it called stippling. And this pattern correlated with quality of tobacco. So the stippled tobacco, on average, came from places that made better tobacco. So purchasers saw cigars with stippled tobacco as high-quality cigars. Somebody invents and patents a process for stippling tobacco, for faking the effect. And the infringer who does it, too, says, look, this is clearly a device to defraud consumers. But it's a legal device to defraud consumers. We're not actually saying it's high-quality tobacco. They're just looking at it, and we're allowed to make our tobacco look good, so we can do it, too. And he wins. Great case. Anyway. See, law can be fun. You may not believe it at this stage in your careers, but once in a while it can be. Let's talk a little bit. Actually, let me talk a little bit before we get to the end of it about one of the issues that comes up in some of this discussion. I'm skipping over some things. And that's the question of patent as monopoly, and in particular of patent not just as the monopoly it's supposed to be, but as a way of getting around the antitrust laws. All right? So let's imagine that there are five companies making film, and you're the owner and CEO of one of those companies. And it costs you about $1 to make a roll of film, And you know that if you try to sell it for very much more than a dollar, one of the other companies will undercut you, because after all, if you're selling it for $1.50, if they sold it for $1.49, they still make 49 cents and they get sell lots of film. So what does it going to occur to you to do? Let us imagine that you're thinking of maybe having a nice dinner for people in the film industry, just to get to know each other. So what do you think might be the sensible thing for you to do? Because like many other people, you'd like to be richer than you are. Most people would like to be richer than they are. So what occurs to you? No aspiring CEOs here. What would you like to do? Yeah? What? No, these are the other people who are other producers that you're going to get together. Yeah.
Agree.
Yeah.
Agree that you will sell it at that price, but that no one is agreeing.
Right. Which probably means to agree to reduce your output in order that you can sell at a higher price. So let me. I had here somewhere, if I can find it, my favorite quote on this subject. People of the same trade seldom meet together, even for merriment and diversion. But the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public or in some contrivance to raise prices. That's Adam Smith writing in 1776. Now, people will tell you that this shows he was in favor of antitrust law. But if they tell you that, tell them to read the rest of the paragraph. It is impossible, indeed, to prevent such meetings by any law which either could be executed or would be consistent with liberty and justice. But though the law cannot hinder people of the same trade from sometimes assembling together, it ought to do nothing to facilitate such assemblies, much less to make them necessary. So he was arguing actually against legal regulations that helped encourage cartel formation. He wasn't arguing that you could actually make cartels illegal. But you can certainly see that from your standpoint as one of those five companies, it would make a lot of sense to say to the others, look, how about we all cut output 10%, raise prices 15% or whatever it is, and we'll all be better off. What are you going to be worried about when that happens? What are you afraid will happen? I have another quote which I didn't extract, or I'd be showing it to you. You're company number five. All right, company number one has gotten this great deal, and now film is up to $1.50. So what is going to occur to you what you ought to be doing?
We should probably break the rules.
We should probably be quiet about it. Make more film, maybe find some big customers and say, look, as long as you don't tell them, we can give you a special deal. We'll sell it to you for $1.40. All right? And the quote, which I'll find for next time, is a quote from Rockefeller. This is before Standard Oil, when Rockefeller was involved with production of petroleum, I think in Pennsylvania or something. And he was involved with an attempted cartel of the drilling, of the companies producing it. And he says that, you know, despite these agreements, all of these people, many of them men of honor and, you know, high standards, could not prevent a little more oil from coming out than they had told their associates and us would be produced. I think he was when they were selling it through, as I remember, the middleman. So that's the problem. But now, how might you solve that problem now that we remember this is an IP course? So you're one of these five companies, and you say, all of us would like to be able to, in effect, sign a contract that would enforce the cartel agreement. Unfortunately, cartel agreements are not enforceable in Anglo-American common law just at the moment. So what might we do instead? Remembering that, yeah, that film production is something that uses lots of technology, right? Lots of, yeah. Yes?
You create a process and then patent it and then license it, is that right? So that everyone in the industry is using the process.
Right. So you could imagine different ways of doing it. So suppose, and it doesn't really require the process is essential. Only that you own that I get a patent on a process, which is one of six ways of making film. And you get a patent on a process, which is another one of six ways. And we then say to each other and to the other three guys, look, we've got this proposal. You license our patents, we'll license your patents, and each of us agrees that every time we sell a roll of film using the patented process, we will pay 50 cents to the patent holder. All right? And we're all paying this among each other. But that means that each of us gains some money when the other guy sells film and has to pay 50 cents when he sells film, which means that the real cost to me of film is now more like $1.50 instead of a dollar, because it in fact includes the fact that when I sell the film, I've got to pay you some royalties. Furthermore, I certainly don't want to cut your sales because I'm making some money out of your sales too. So it's pretty straightforward to imagine how you would set up a contract using patents, which would be the effect of the legally unenforceable contract and restraint of trade for a cartel. So that's part of the problem that's being discussed here, and I just thought it was worth going through. If we had more time, there are more things we could talk about, but that's all right. All right, so you're going to read another chunk of this stuff for next time. I hope that if things don't make sense to you, you'll take notes and come bother me about them in class Thursday, and I will see you then.